And good afternoon. It is 12:02, Friday the 17th, which makes it the last business Friday of the year. I'm Eric Scott. Hello there. As usual, our guest State Senator Majority Leader Wolfboro resident Jeb Bradley, along with State Representative Brody Deshaies, is with us as well. And welcome to you both.
Thank you for having me, Eric.
Well, no problem. Senator, what's going on? You got plans for the holiday?
Yeah, just trying to stay safe and enjoy family and, you know, maybe take some walks with Napoleon. How's that?
Oh, that sounds pretty good. What do you have anything that you're working on right now that you'll be ready to go for when the session kicks off?
So I've got several bills that, you know, are in the hopper, so to speak. One that, you know, Brody signed on with me for, which is continued effort to fix our so-called bail reform situation. I mean, thankfully, New Hampshire never got it as wrong as other states did. But we've also seen people that have been arrested for violent crimes, a lot of times domestic abuse type situations, which can escalate really rapidly, and they get no bail, released back out on the street right after being arrested with a court date, and go out and recommit a crime. And obviously, the situation, a tragic situation in Wisconsin, should, you know, point out as a nation how dangerous, you know, the situation is to have a revolving door. I introduced a bill last year, Senate Bill 92, passed the Senate pretty easily. The House held it up for study. I think Brody was really helpful in trying to push it along. My understanding is there's the House Criminal Justice Committee has an 11-10 vote that it should pass. So hopefully in the first week that we're back, you know, from January, that bill will pass. The bill I'm introducing this year is the same bill, pretty much, a couple of small changes. But, you know, the House can pass the bill from last year. This other bill may not be necessary. But to me, you know, it is got to be one of the top issues that we confront in New Hampshire. I mean, people expect more than anything else that government will provide a certain level of safety for people in, you know, their workplace, on our nation's streets, in our homes, in schools, in, you know, any public places. And, you know, the whole move to defund the police and some of the other corresponding, you know, things that have happened to undermine the ability of law enforcement to enforce our laws, and then, you know, have a revolving door of letting criminals out on the street. We've seen the tragic consequences of it. So I really appreciate Brody's help, and hopefully we get this bill on the governor's desk pretty quickly.
Brody, can you tell us kind of how you helped push this thing over the, you know, toward the goal line?
Well, it's about calling up other legislators and explaining to them that the current system that we have right now, the reform, so to speak, was a mistake in the first place. I never supported it when it first happened before I even got involved in elected politics. From the get-go, I didn't think it was necessary, right? It's pretty explicit in our, you know, in our U.S. Constitution that there won't be excessive bail. The bails were not excessive, and they kept people who were, quite frankly, you know, who are committing dangerous crimes and who could be reoffending off the streets, making it so then communities are safe and ensuring that they actually showed up to their court date and that justice could be properly served. I mean, we've seen, as the senator mentioned, we've seen a number of violent criminals committing crimes or, so to speak, you know, about to commit a crime or, you know, committing a lesser crime and then later on committing a worse crime. Within 48 hours sometimes. There was an example in Manchester where a woman called the police and, you know, I can't remember, I think they had a domestic dispute, but there was no violence, but they had a domestic dispute and he was arrested for another reason. And within 24 hours, he found her at another location, I think a friend's house, criminally trespassed, and they had, you know, there was a domestic violence situation. And this was someone who was released on the PR bail. So it's kind of hard for the current system puts way too much of a burden onto the legal system to really determine who can and can't qualify for PR bail and, you know, what the best situation is, right? We left it a little bit too vague. I mean, we're not as bad as other states where you basically tie the hands of the judicial system from even, you know, requiring bail. But I think we need to go back to the old version personally. But, you know, what we have going forward is going to be a good solution to help prevent violent criminals from being on our streets and help create a certain amount of safety and security within Granite Staters' communities.
How did it work, Senator? How did it work beforehand? I've never been arrested, so I really don't know how.
Let's keep it that way, Eric.
Yeah, I'll try.
Yeah. Don't go doing any wild and crazy things, Eric.
So, I'm too old for that now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would obviously be, in the past, have been a case-by-case basis. People would be eligible for bail unless they were seen to be at risk to themselves or to the public. And then, you know, they would be denied bail. So the efforts behind bail reform were to make sure that if people were going to get bail, that, you know, lower income people could have the same access to bail as people with more resources. Okay, so that's reasonable if bail is going to be granted. If you're not a risk to yourself and you're not a risk of reoffending in a violent way to undermine the safety of the public. But what happened is, despite the best intentions of trying to even it up in terms of income level, it virtually created an open door where way too many people got bail that shouldn't have gotten bail. And, you know, there have been some violent incidences in New Hampshire of people that reoffended right away. I mean, there was an incident where somebody, I think, was pulled over by the police in a traffic incident, was arrested because they had, I can't remember the details, but they'd committed some sort of violent storefront robbery or something like that. They got released, and then, you know, that same person 24 hours later tried to set a middle school on fire enforcement, as I recall the details. And, you know, there are plenty of others that have happened too that are cause for concern. So what this bill would do, first and foremost, is that for a list of violent-type crimes, ranging from domestic abuse to murder, anybody getting bail would have to go before a judge. And it wouldn't just be automatic. And, you know, I worked on this bill with the police chiefs. I think they're obviously very concerned with a revolving door. They helped me write it, and, you know, kudos to them. I think our police force are under huge duress in this country right now with the whole defund movement and everybody questioning everything they're doing, when really what they're, you know, trying to do, and oftentimes it's life and death, split-second decisions, you know, that they have to protect themselves or protect others, and everybody's second-guessing them who really don't know how law enforcement works. It's a very difficult and dangerous profession. It always has been, but, you know, with so many people taking pot shots at our police officers now, you know, that's made it even worse, and it's really wrong. And I think, you know, one thing that Brody and I have really agreed on and worked hard, I mean, we've, you know, talked to Dean Rondo, chiefs in Wolfboro, I talked to other chiefs, you know, all the time, trying to make sure that we're doing everything that we can to back the blue, so to speak. And Brody was, you know, there was a bill last year, unfortunately, it's coming back again this year, to take away the limited immunity protection that police officers have in some of these violent confrontations. And that would just make it even worse in terms of, you know, being able to retain and keep police officers on the job, because, you know, they're going to be even questioned more and subject to more, you know, false charges and criminal prosecution and things like that for just trying to protect us and protect the public. Brody did a really good job of, you know, highlighting the problems with that bill last year. And, you know, hopefully, Brody, you're going to be able to do the same thing this year and keep it away from you know, getting to the Senate. I mean, I think if it gets to the Senate, we'd kill it, but, you know, it would be unfortunate if it did.
Brody, what's wrong with the bill?
With ending qualified immunity? Well, yes. let me give you an example. Right now,
I'm not taking a position. I'm just saying
what's wrong with it? So what's it wrong with? So qualified immunity is a very important legal principle that we've had established in case law since the 1980s. Right, I believe it's 1982, but there's other precedents going farther back to the 1970s that kind of established the landmark case that really puts forth what is qualified immunity. Qualified immunity is essentially the balancing of keeping public officials at fault, keeping them held accountable, but ensuring that they have the ability, that they have the leeway to do their job. So when they're practicing their job, whether you're a police officer, someone who works for the Department of Transportation, a firefighter, etc., that if you are properly trained in doing your job and actively on duty, that you have a certain amount of leeway, and that if things happen that are out of your control that might have a negative effect on someone else in the public, that you won't be held personally liable, right? Now, a community can still be held liable if they're, if someone decides to sue. But what happens is we have a legal screening before a case like that will go to court, qualified immunity, right? Mm-hmm. And so judges will basically decide whether or not to permit a case to go forward or not. And it's based upon whether or not there are previously established statutory or case law that can back up that this case, that this, a specific public servant, a specific public worker has indeed violated someone's statutory, civil, or constitutional rights. So instead of letting the case go to court always, like we would in a private tort case where nearly every case, goes to either to settlement or to court, we put a screening on, in this country, there's a screening to prevent frivolous lawsuits, to prevent major costs to taxpayers, and to prevent municipal insurance rates from going up. So what would happen if this bill went into place? Well, I'll give you a few examples. One, you'd see, as the senator mentioned, you'd see massive, massive retirement of more police officers. We're already down about 50 officers in our state police. We're down hundreds of officers across the state and local departments. We're already short, our volunteer firefighters across the state. And so less people would be inclined to work because they wouldn't have that basic legal immunity to be able to do their job. An example of something that someone could be personally liable for would be if you're a volunteer firefighter, and you resuscitated someone who had a non-resuscitation order, but you didn't know.
Okay, yeah.
So you could be held personally liable and sued in court and go through years of legal fees and then have to pay a fine for saving someone's life. Think about that. And so that's what this bill would have done. And it was pushed by, it was pushed by some very libertarian-leaning members of my own caucus and some very progressive members. They came together and decided that they thought that stripping these kind of legal immunities from public servants, from police officers, from firefighters, from the people who defend our lives on a daily basis, that this made sense, that we should open up the floodgates to a numerous amounts of frivolous lawsuits for municipalities to deal with, and it would make your property taxes increase because we'd have to pay law enforcement way more to even get someone to show up for an interview, let alone the fact that the insurance rates that we pay, because every municipality pays insurance rates, that the insurance rates would go through the roof, right? So everyone's property taxes would increase. We would have had less police officers, less firefighters, less public servants in general. And there was even questions about whether or not that someone could personally sue elected officials in towns. For example, if you thought a planning board or a ZBA incorrectly decided something, would they be open to liability? And could they be personally sued? So now you have people who are serving on volunteer boards and commissions in your community or in your county who are going to be open to lawsuit also. So, I mean, you look at all these things, and it was well-intended. No one wants police brutality in their community, right, in their state, anywhere in this country, right? But the question is qualified immunity to prevent police brutality? No, because at the end of the day, what we can stop police brutality by passing laws that improve training for police officers, that improve the standards, and by establishing very simple statutory things that police can't do to individuals that they've apprehended. For example, like putting a knee on someone's neck, which is already against the law,
right?
Which someone was already brought, when we saw with the whole Derek Chauvin case, he was already brought to justice. And, you know, that was a prime example of why people push this legislation. People like Derek Chauvin aren't brought to justice. Well, look, justice was served. So
in that one case.
It's going to continue happening, though, as public opinion has changed very strongly, as judges have become a lot more cognizant of these issues, as states pass laws to make it so then that there's, you know, that there's basic requirements for how police officers treat the public. The case law is going to be established where the screens for qualified immunity become much more realistic and in tune of what the expectations of the public are. We shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And this is what I told members of my own caucus. This is what I told members of the Democratic caucus. We had to convince 65 about Democrats to vote for this, a lot of them former law enforcement. And it was like pulling teeth, I'll tell you. But we had to do it because there were members of my own caucus who decided that, I guess, higher property taxes and making it harder for police officers and other public servants to do their job and, you know, basically undermining the thin blue line that defends our communities, that was the best way going forward to help address some of these issues, which, by the way, has not been in any demonstrable way an issue in New Hampshire. This tends to be an issue in a number of other larger, more industrial sites and might I mention Democratic states. So,
all right, Senator, so to sum this up into a 30-second soundbite, basically, there'll be an assumption of immunity, and only a judge can waive it. Is that pretty much how it goes?
No. You under the law today, you have this immunity granted to you if you're a police officer. That it's limited and it's qualified. I mean, obviously, you can't break a law or, you know, be willfully reckless or anything like that. But there are situations Brody talked about that. You know, you could potentially be subject to a lawsuit without this immunity. And it just will undermine the ability of police officers, A, to do their job, B, to want to do their job. And that becomes dangerous. I think we have seen around the country, the whole defund the police movement, that where it's taken off and where there has been less funding and positions cut or police retiring because you know, they're taking so much abuse, the murder rate, the violent crime rate has soared, and people are sick and tired of it. And, you know, it's funny, we were at almost all-time, well, maybe not all-time lows, but a very low rate of crime in this country compared to where we were 20, 30 years ago, and we've, like, thrown that out the window with some of these policies that basically reward criminals and punish victims a second time, and, you know, we are seeing a crime wave. And I think both Brody and I are, you know, on these, you know, two bills that we're talking about, qualified immunity, making sure that police officers have it, and fixing the bail situation that, you know, we created a few years ago that, you know, is not good. If we want to have safe streets, safe homes, safe schools, et cetera, we've got to have the laws in place to defend that. And that's, you know, to me, you asked what my top priority was at the top. I mean, I think that obviously, you know, COVID is another top priority too, but that's a very high priority for me.
There's a case going on right now. In fact, as we speak, a police officer is on trial for shooting a suspect instead of using her taser. She claims to have confused or pulled her gun when she meant to pull her taser. I realize that we weren't there, nor are any of us lawyers, but is that the kind of thing that this qualified immunity bill is meant to protect? Because,
well, she was charged with a criminal count, okay?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And whether she's found guilty or not is in the hands of 12 jurors.
Right.
And I understand she's testifying in her own defense today. And so, you know, we'll see what happens. And I can't prejudge that case. I'm not, you know, a juror. I'm not, you know, privy to some of the information that is out there. But, you know, we have a jury system to decide those cases. So if somebody's charged criminally for, you know, as a police officer, they're going to get charged. They're going to go to trial. And then, like all the rest of us that you know, would get charged with a crime, there'll be a trial by jury in a case like that that rises to that level. And that's the way the system should be. The qualified immunity is more for a situation of civil liability so that people aren't getting sued.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, what the senator said, too, and I think it's a prime example also, is that, you know, if this police officer that you mentioned is found, criminally liable, then that could open them up to civil suits. And it's a prime example of why qualified immunity is needed, because, you know, there should be times where someone might be open to, you know, if they've committed a criminal thing like that, where maybe they are open to some kind of civil liability or community, maybe based on maybe if they have subpar training standards, or if their recruitment, if they aren't following their recruitment policies and everything, and actually hiring people who are, et cetera, right? So qualified immunity is just essentially, people treat it as if it's like a get out of jail free pass for law enforcement. It's not. It's just a legal screening to understand at what point, is someone going to be liable who's a law enforcement officer, and at what point are they not, right? And it creates a legal screening so then we can protect the interests of taxpayers, protect the interests of the safety of communities, protect the interests of people who serve those communities, and ensure that we're creating a good environment for people to be hired and to work as police officers, firefighters, or any other. I mean, that's a big thing about the qualified immunity bill in New Hampshire that they tried to, well, getting rid of qualified immunity in New Hampshire, you know, the bill to ban qualified immunity in New Hampshire would have opened up liability to, say, you know, a DOT worker, right? Mm-hmm. The person who holds the sign, you know, the stop and go sign, right? Which is actually, it would have been the most expansive, ending of qualified immunity in any state in this country. It would have gone even farther than what AOC wants regarding ending qualified immunity, right? So, I mean, we're talking about, this is left of Lenin policies being pushed in New Hampshire. And a lot of people, you know, one, don't entirely grasp what qualified immunity is. And that's, you know, that's no fault of their own. That's the fault of, you know, a media that isn't properly, you know, I'd say reporting it and really in depth explaining it properly. And to public officials who are using this to take advantage of for their own political gains, quite frankly. So.
And Eric, I'd just say one more thing.
Sure.
Our law enforcement agencies in New Hampshire, starting with the Attorney General's office and working down through the state police, the county sheriffs, and local police, I think have done a really good job of, you know, trying to be transparent. We're opening up the so-called Lori list more for, you know, identifying misbehavior among police officers. Training is better. There's a better understanding of, you know, how to do outreach with certain communities. So I think our law enforcement has responded in a very positive way. And I think that, you know, people like myself and Brody and others need to stand behind law enforcement and give them the tools that they need and the resources that they need to do their job, knowing that they are also looking at their practices and procedures and trying to get better in what they do. Because they see their job as really important. It's to provide safety for all of us. And what's, quite frankly, we're seeing it every night on TV with smash and grab, with Antifa riots, rising crime rates, murder rates, et cetera. Our brave men and women in law enforcement are, they're the difference between, you know, just chaos and trying to keep our streets safe. Anyway.
Is there anything our state can do to help recruit and train more police officers?
Well, I think the biggest thing is what we don't do, and it's don't pass qualified immunity or repeal of qualified immunity. You know, fix our bail system. Make sure that, we don't overreact to efforts to politicize, you know, law enforcement and, you know, adopt some of these, you know, policing strategies of defunding the police. I mean, those are all crazy, quite frankly. And supporting law enforcement, making sure they have the resources, and making sure they're held accountable you know, when something does go wrong, and I would say this to end it, 99.9% of our police officers are good citizens that want to do a good job. And there's nothing that hates a bad police officer more than a good police officer, because it gives all the rest of them a really bad name. And I think that's very, very true in New Hampshire.
Okay. 1227 here on WASR. Senator Jeb Bradley is with us, and Brody DeShays is with us as well on a very, very sunny Friday afternoon. Snow tomorrow, by the way. 3 to 5 inches, it looks like, at this point. Yay. I know a lot of people are excited about it, but I got to confess I'm not one of them. All right, next question. Senator, the GOP looks to have the momentum heading into the midterms. Can they stay together long enough to hold power? Because, like, the Democrats are literally falling apart. There's no adhesion there, I don't think. You know, when one or two senators can hold up a $2 trillion bill, you got to wonder.
Well, Eric, it's not one or two senators. It's the majority of the United States Senate.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Has said enough already. You know, look at the data that came out, you know, last Friday for, I guess it was October, the highest rate of inflation, you know, in 40 years. The producer price index came out earlier this week, another record high, you know, so terrible things. You know, and all this government money chasing too few goods and services, that's inflation. That's the definition of inflation. And we're seeing it. And the people that hit the worst are hardworking Americans, whether it's, you know, gas for their car to get to work, whether it's putting food on their table, whether it's any number of other things that are basic commodities that have just gone up. And, you know, you have the supply chain shortage. So these issues are the result of policies coming out of Washington. And that's why the Biden administration, poll after poll after poll, is totally underwater. Now, you know, there's a long ways to go for the midterms. There's 11 months. A lot can change and a lot can happen. But we've seen this situation before. And I think that the mounting crises, and unfortunately, I hate to say this, but it would not surprise me one bit to see an international crisis that makes Afghanistan pale in comparison. If, you know, China does something vis-a-vis Taiwan after the Olympics, or if the Russians invade, you know, Ukraine, North Korea, Iran. I mean, so when you have inflation, you have border chaos, you have rising gas and energy prices, supply chain shortages, you know, on and on and on and on and on. And then throw in Afghanistan and the possibility of, you know, the weakness that is being perceived in Washington causing dictators around the world to say, how can I take advantage of this? I think this is why the Biden administration is underwater. And, you know, we'll see what happens, but I think for our country's sake, we obviously, you know, want these problems to be resolved, but there's just no ability to resolve them in Washington. And, you know, to get back to the Build Back Better, well, they postponed that, you know, because they don't have the votes, because at least 51 senators were opposed. And I am virtually certain that there are several others that shared Manchin, several other Democrat senators shared Manchin's point of view, but didn't want to poke the bear, so-called poking, you know, the progressives in their wing of the party by coming out and being opposed to it. And they were riding behind, you know, Manchin's coattails on that, and fine. But, you know, Senator Schumer, the majority leader in the Senate, said, no, we're not going to do that. And now they're turning to election reform. And if you thought bail reform was a problem, just wait until the feds take over every state's election, which is what they're trying to do. Goodbye voter ID, which is supported by, you know, about 80% of the public in New Hampshire. Mail-in balloting, which, you know, leads to, you know, fraud potentially, or at least the opportunity for it. So, you know, we have a good voting system in New Hampshire. Yes, there are problems, okay? The Bedford situation, Windham, but they're anomalies. I think Bill Gardner's done a really good job. And the anomalies that came were a result of just the influx of absentee ballots, I think, you know, in November of 2020. But our elections are good in New Hampshire. Why would we think that, you know, a government that can't secure our borders can secure our ballot boxes? I don't think so. And that's what, you know, that's what they're going to turn to next. And I think the poll numbers will continue to go down.
Brody, your thoughts?
Well, people are struggling, putting food on the table. And all that people in Washington, D.C. can think about right now is increasing taxes. They want to increase income tax. They want to increase corporate tax. They want to increase, you know, interest and dividends, capital gains. You know, in this state, Democrats, they want to do the same thing. Increase taxes on small businesses. Increase the meals and rooms tax. Increase the capital gains tax, which will even, you know, that's a tax on selling your home. And, you know, I can't see how in any way that this is going to help Granite Staters that are right now being kicked in the teeth with inflation. I can't see how the Build Back, you know, the Build Back Broke plan, the Build Back Millionaires plan, I can't see how that in any way is going to help Granite Staters and how it's going to fight back against this inflation, right? Inflation, according to public polling, is the biggest concern of Granite Staters and all Americans across all age demographics, across all political spectrum. It's inflation. That is the issue that people are facing. Spending more isn't going to solve the problem. Spending less will, right? Helping deliver tax relief as New Hampshire Republicans have, helping deliver more property tax relief as New Hampshire Republicans have done, $100 million in property tax relief. Wolfboro will see, I believe, $1.2 million saved from less property taxes collected by the state government. You know, look, Erica, we really need to consider, you know, where we were under New Hampshire Democrats about 2 years ago, where we are now in this state, and then also think about where we were under the Trump administration. Think about, you know, how much different it is under the Biden administration, how much more spending, how bad inflation is. I mean, look, when inflation's at 7% as it is right now, imagine that throughout an entire year. Now, imagine the average American gets 26 paychecks. If inflation increases 7%, that's essentially as if last year we took away two of your 26 paychecks, right?
Yeah. Well, as the senator has said many times, inflation is a tax on the poorest Americans.
Well, it is. It you know, and the senator's right, and everyone who has always said that has always been correct. And, you know, and that's what it is. I mean, essentially, you know, D.C. Democrats and the Biden administration and by extension the New Hampshire Democrats that support the Build Back Broke programs and everything and the Green New Deal, they essentially want to take away of the 26 paychecks that, you know, Granite Staters get every year. They want to take away two of them. That's what they want to do. And that's as if you missed, you know, that would be like if a Granite Stater lost about, you know, a month's pay. Okay. More or less. That's how much it hurts these people. That's how much it hurts folks like myself. People feel it at the gas pump. They feel it at the grocery store. Yeah. They feel it everywhere they go. And it's not fair. And really, you know, people need to wake up and remember this in 2022. And really consider, you know, what's best for them, their families, and their pocketbooks.
Senator, can you tell me what, if anything, the recent inflation will do to this New Hampshire budget?
Yeah, I think that remains to be seen. Obviously, you know, energy is essential for any number of things, and so every department will have to, you know, pay to heat their buildings or cool their buildings, cars, gasoline, that kind of thing. So energy, you know, will ripple through higher energy prices through the state budget. The good news is we are running surpluses because I think under Governor Sununu's leadership and the wise policies that we've adopted in the budget. We've grown the economy, and revenue is, you know, coming in on a very strong basis. So we'll be able to, you know, I think, weather any budgetary impact, but certainly, you know, the ability to do road and bridge repair when so much of that, you know, is energy related in the production of asphalt or the cost of steel, which has gone through the roof. Those projects are, you know, going to go through the roof. And, you know, we're in a labor shortage. And so, you know, the cost of hiring people has gone up exponentially. So, you know, inflation hits. It hits hard. And it will have an impact on the New Hampshire budget. But I think right now, at least, you know, through the first 5 months of the fiscal year, which started on July 1st, I believe we're over $100 million in the black, over revenue higher than anticipated. So that's a good thing.
Yes, it is. Now, what happens to that money? Does that get held in a rainy day fund? Does that get put back into programs that were cut? Or what would happen to that?
So what will happen, what we did, you know, in the last budget is we were also running surpluses at the end. Remember, you know, when I first started doing this show during the pandemic, you know, with you, Eric, in March and April and May of 2020, and, you know, the economy fell through the floor and revenue dropped through the floor, we thought we were in, you know, a world of hurt.
Right,
we could be
as
$500 million short. We ended up, you know, fiscal 2021 came in much stronger, and we ended up in the black. And so we rolled that money into, you know, either going into the rainy day fund, which we enhanced, which is a good thing, and paid for initiatives that I think we need to pay for, like more mental health funding, substance abuse, that kind of thing, enhancements to the Division of Child, Youth, and Families to try to better prevent child abuse and neglect, you know, those things that required more money. So, you know, we've got a long ways to go. We're not even a quarter of the way through, you know, this budget. We're 5 months of revenue. We'll see how December does. That will mark the, you know, the quarter pole. December's always a pretty big month for revenue, but I would anticipate we're, you know, going to stay on course and stay strong.
That's great. 1240 on WASR. Thank you very much for listening this afternoon. I'm Eric Scott. Our guest, Senator Jeb Bradley and State Representative Brody DeShays, both of Wolfboro. We touched on this briefly during All Things Politics on Wednesday afternoon about a email that was sent out by Democratic Representative Lucy Weber of Walpole, taking the GOP to task for blocking the ability of committees to meet virtually, which is House Rule 67. I looked it up. Didn't I hear somewhere that committees were already meeting virtually?
So, Eric, what happened under the emergency orders starting in the spring of 2020 and carried through till April and May of 2021 is that we, under the governor's emergency order, were authorized to meet via Zoom platforms, which is a remote, you know, platform over your computer that everybody can participate and the public could testify. So it was like having, you know, a remote hearing, but everybody was there. It worked out pretty well. Now we're, you know, and I recognize, obviously, that we're, you know, in the throes of the winter surge that the governor talked about for the last several months, and we have to get through it. I think we should talk about that for a moment after this. The problem is you can't have a hybrid system with the level of staff that we have in either the Senate or the House. It takes a lot of infrastructure to be able to run committee hearings, whether it's in person or whether it's remotely. And we can do one or we can do the other. And right now, you know, I think the decision has been made. We're not under an emergency order that we're going to do it in person. Obviously, we're in the Senate, and I'm not sure what the House is going to do. We are going to live stream everything so people, you know, can watch from the comfort of their office or their home or whatever and not have to come in, you know, to the State House to testify. And obviously, people can testify, you know, without being able to testify verbally. They can submit an email, a letter in writing, then contact their rep, like Brody takes calls all the time, as do I, contact their senator. You know, so I think that we've tried to make access to the public as good as possible during this very trying time. And, you know, we'll have to see how it works. And hopefully, you know, as we get through the holiday season, this is what happened last year, the numbers started to go down again. I hope that it will be the case. I mean, obviously we have, you know, high numbers right now. Our hospital capacity is stretched, and my hat's off to every professional healthcare worker or volunteer too, for doing what they're doing to, you know, try to get through the pandemic. And, you know, before, you know, I came on the show with you, Eric, and I do a show with Jack Heath earlier in the morning, you know, I looked up the vaccination rates, and I think it's important to know because obviously there's a lot of, you know, discussion about vaccines right now and whether it should be mandatory or not, okay? And setting that discussion aside, just the actual numbers, according to CDC numbers that are current through, I believe it was December 14th, so just a couple of days ago, New Hampshire leads the nation, all right? Let me repeat that. Leads the nation in the percentage of our people eligible for vaccination that have gotten at least one vaccine dose, okay? I believe that for fully vaccinated, meaning you, if it's Moderna and Pfizer, you've had your first two shots and a booster, or in my case, I had Johnson & Johnson, so one shot and one booster, we are at 64%, and we're, I think, 11th in the country. So our vaccination status on a voluntary basis has been pretty darn good. And I think that, you know, people are trying to get vaccinated now. There was a vaccine blitz for boosters that the governor, you know, set up last weekend. Another one's coming. We're setting up fixed sites for vaccinations. That is, you know, probably the best thing that people can do if they're not vaccinated is to think about getting vaccinated and talk to your physician. I'm not a supporter of, you know, losing your job if you decide you don't want to get vaccinated, because there are some legit reasons that people may be a little reluctant. Myocarditis for young men, women of childbearing age, people who've already had COVID. I get that, but you know, we're doing pretty well with voluntary vaccination rates. Talk to your physician. You know, I think the governor's gone to great ends to make, you know, vaccines as available as possible for people that want to get vaccinated. And, you know, hopefully people will. And, you know, I was kind of astounded, quite frankly, to read that, you know, U.S. News and World Reports reporting CDC guidelines that we were, I think it was 92 or 93% vaccinated, more than any other state for an initial dose.
Then how did we get to be number one in per capita infections? Or was that just the winter surge?
I think it's the winter surge. And I, look, if you look at where, you know, in the country the surge is happening, it's in the northern states, okay? And so it's climate related. In the southern part of the country, you know, where people were inside during the summer when it's hot and they go into air conditioning and so they get together with friends and families indoors when it's hot, they had surges going off the charts and we were relatively safe. So the Delta variant is still with us. The new one, the Omicron, you know, is here too. And in New England and across the northern part of the country, people are inside now, and it's the holiday season, so that exacerbates it. You know, people, I hadn't seen my own kids in 2 years, you know, until I drove to Colorado this summer to actually see, you know, my kids and my four grandkids. Hadn't seen them in 2 years because of the pandemic. And people are, you know, they're cooped up and you know, they're trying to get on with their lives. And we should be getting on with our lives, but we need to be careful, too. And, you know, so getting vaccinated, and when you are going to get together, just, you know, be cautious with social distancing. I'm not suggesting people need to wear masks indoors, but just be cautious. And, you know, because that's where the infection rate is going up so much.
Okay. The recent program that lasted, what, 24 hours was to put COVID testing kits in the hands of people. I got some. In fact, I had a test a couple of days ago because I've had a runny nose for days, and I just wanted to make sure that it wasn't, you know, COVID. And it wasn't, by the way. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. But isn't it, now, I also heard this morning that that program may be renewed. Do you know about that, Senator?
Look, I think that part of the problem had become, remember the executive council, I think it was in October-November timeframe, at first did not take federal money to, you know, pay for some of the, you know, booster sites and the in-home testing and things like that. They finally reversed course, and now they've approved, you know, more federal money to, you know, pay for hospital enhancements, and I think there's another vote are coming this week. I think the governor is doing everything he can to respond to, you know, the crisis at hospitals and trying to increase bed capacity and get testing kits into people's hands. I mean, like you, Eric, I had a runny nose, and I think it was in late September, and it took me three times going down to the Alton ClearMD site before I could actually, you know, get tested myself. Because they didn't have a reservation system, and I, you know, would have had to wait 3 hours there, so I just drove home. So we need to have that adequacy of testing, you know, that, again, the tests that you just cited are getting much more readily available now.
Yeah, I noticed, though, it says right on the box that it's emergency use authorization. The FDA hasn't finished their approval process yet. Does that make you nervous?
You know, I mean, I think that that goes back to where some people are a bit nervous about the vaccine, because it's really only been out and being put in people's arms for about a year. I mean, remember, it's about a year ago this time that the first, you know, healthcare workers and first responders started to get vaccinated. So, you know, I think that the medical professionals and the researchers that, you know, whether it's Pfizer or Moderna or Johnson & Johnson or AstraZeneca or any of these drug companies that are, you know, Merck has a pill or the monoclonal antibodies, they're all pretty new. And, you know, based on that, people, you know, have a little bit of reticence sometimes. I mean, look, I didn't. I felt I like I do with, you know, all the type of personal decisions that I have to make, I always try to do in my own head a risk and benefit analysis. Is there a risk to taking, you know, any kind of medication or a vaccine or eating certain foods or whatever it may be? Going climbing Mount Washington in the middle of winter, you know, but is there a benefit? And so when I thought about the vaccination, you know, I added up what I thought were the risks. I thought they were, in my case, pretty minimal. And I added up the benefits, and I thought they were pretty big. And I got a vaccination. And thank God, you know, no side effects. And, you know, I got the booster when I was eligible to get the booster. And I hope that that's a decision that, you know, people think through their own healthcare, you know, criteria. Talk to your doctor or your medical provider and get his or her opinion as, you know, to your case. Because I asked my own physician this, Eric, a couple of months ago. I said, Doc, what are you telling your patients, to get vaccinated or not to get vaccinated? He said, I always go to everybody's personal health care information and talk them through their own circumstances. Virtually everybody, I recommend they get vaccinated. But there are a few people that, for whatever reason, their health, you know, probably not the best idea. So that does happen. And, you know, but I think, you know, certainly with the surge of cases, I think there's, you know, people are thinking about it more and more, and hopefully, you know, we have the supply of vaccine and the availability of it to get shots in the arms. But I am buoyed by the fact that, you know, as a state, we have the highest percentage in the nation of people that have had at least one dose.
Okay. What is it, though, with the original denial of the federal funds, which from the Executive Council, something about it would subject us to vaccine or mask mandates from the federal government? Isn't New Hampshire one of the states that's suing to block those mandates?
Yes. So President Biden, in, I believe it was September, ordered all federal contractors, all federal employees, any company that had 100 or more employees, and all healthcare facilities that took Medicaid or Medicare funds to have all staff vaccinated, okay, or lose their job. And so Governor Sununu is one of, I think, 10 or 12 other governors around the country that sued in particular about the lose your job provision. Okay, so the courts thus far have upheld the position of Governor Sununu that you can't force somebody at the threat of losing their job to get vaccinated. Okay, now the law that we passed in New Hampshire last year that had, you know, quite a bit of support, says the government in New Hampshire is not going to mandate a COVID vaccine. But we were silent on whether a hospital could mandate it, and some hospitals, you know, have, without the federal, you know, requirement that, you know, is now in abeyance, have decided that in their interest, they're going to mandate, you know, their employees to get vaccinated. They've also allowed for religious and medical exceptions that have covered most people, unfortunately, maybe not all. So we've tried to, you know, sort of thread the needle and saying the government's not going to order it, but, you know, we're not going to interfere in the way a business or an organization like a hospital runs their business. And I kind of think that's consistent with the way that people like myself think that, you know, the overarching reach of government should not be telling a business or a hospital or whatever how they do their business. And so, you know, there's been some controversy about that, no question about it. But I think it's been, you know, again, we tried to thread the needle.
I understand. Now, this means that a private business could enact their own mandate, and there's no problem there, right?
It would not be against the law currently in New Hampshire. Now, some people want to change that, and we'll have that debate, you know, this winter.
I wouldn't even
call it a mandate.
Yeah,
kind of monopolized things here. I think,
that's fine.
You know, we should get Brody in here.
That's fine. No, I'm enjoying it. A lot to learn. A lot of a wealth of wisdom here on WASR with Senator Bradley. I wouldn't call it a mandate, though. A business requiring a vaccine for, you know, setting their own health and safety standards, whether it be a vaccine or whatever else have you, you know, requirement in the workplace that they have an expectation set. That's, you know, negotiated privately in a contract between an employee and an employer. It's not a mandate, right? Because a mandate is something, you know, that comes from government. That's a one-size-fits-all kind of solution. That's, you know, a requirement that comes from, you know, the backing of, you know, the state itself. It's a negotiation. Right, it's not a mandate. It's a negotiation. An employer will, you know, tell its employees, you know, we would like you to get vaccinated. That's going to be a requirement that we have for employment. And employees can go to employers, right? It was Senator Morris who said the other day at an event that, you know, any business that's requiring a vaccine that's threatening to fire employees in his district, he's called them up and said, you know, in this environment, you're really going to fire your employees? You're going to be that rigid with the vaccine requirements? You know, can you not work with your employees? Can you not find a way? Can you not maybe understand, maybe, you know, if if the person needs a religious exemption or if they have other health issues, etc. So, you know, that's the biggest reason, though, why we shouldn't have a government mandate either for vaccines or against vaccines. And that's because a one-size-fits-all government solution isn't going to work. It's never worked for anything else. Why would it work for vaccinations? And it's not the New Hampshire way, right? It's not the New Hampshire way. It's not live free or die. It's not 603. Let private businesses do as private businesses do, which is best operate without government overreach, and let private individuals negotiate with their employers and let them decide when they want to get vaccinated or where they want to work, right? That's the other thing too. Just because a business is going to require an employee to get vaccinated doesn't mean an employee can't go find a better firm to work at for possibly even for more money. So, you know, the free market it tends to work better than people give it credit, and it tends to do a lot better when government doesn't rear its ugly head into it.
Okay. Your thoughts, Senator?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's how we wrote House Bill 220 last year. I think that most businesses and hospitals and healthcare providers have respected, you know, religious and medical exceptions. I know there've been a handful of people that have lost their jobs. I think that's unfortunate. And, you know, like Senator Morse, I've called, you know, in particular healthcare entities and said, hey, work with your employees. You don't, especially in a healthcare crisis, want to be firing people. And I think, you know, for the most part, they have, and I appreciate that.
What do you tell people who aren't getting vaccinated because of some of the conspiracy theories running around that there's tentacles in it or 5G tracking or whatever? Have you talked to anybody like that, and have you been able to change their opinion?
I have not talked to anybody like that. I have talked to a number of people that have had what I would consider a legitimate concern, you know, medically, whether they're women of childbearing age or they have kids that could be at risk for myocarditis, or in particular, people that have had COVID already and just don't feel that a vaccine is necessary for them. So I have talked to people like that. My advice is the same that I give them that I've said on this show. Talk about what I went through, how I decided, you know, the risk-benefit analysis, and urge them to talk to, you know, their medical provider and then make a decision. And that's all I think that, you know, I feel capable of doing and trying to, you know, walk people through that. But, you know, people, it's a new vaccine, and there has to be an understanding that, you know, we're not talking polio vaccines that have been here for 70 years, okay, that have been completely researched and studied and in terms of their effectiveness and their side effects, okay? This is different. And people, you know, they can be skeptical, and we have to work with that skepticism and try to, you know, direct people to, you know, the experts. And those happen to be, you know, physicians or nurse practitioners or what have you, to advise people. And that's what I've tried to do.
We are unfortunately out of time, but thank you again to Senator Bradley and Representative DeShays for being with us. It's our final Friday show of 2021.
And Merry Christmas, yeah, and Happy New Year to you and Brody and to all your listeners.
You as well, Senator. Thank you, and we'll talk to you in the new year.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Merry Christmas.
Thanks a lot for coming in, Brody. I appreciate it.
As always, and everyone have a Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and we'll see you in the new year. God bless.
News is next.